Marshall, you can proceed when you're ready.
Sounds good. Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals. Morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Ead, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As you know, we are proceeding by Zoom today. For purposes of the recording, today is April 4th, 2024. We have five cases on our calendar today, three oral cases and two non-oral cases. The first oral case is A23-1256, Tanya M. Keim versus Jeremy R. Keim. Hopefully I pronounced the last name correctly. If I didn't, please correct me, counsel. The parties will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. On the grid view, you should be able to see a timer which shows how much time you have remaining in your argument. And the only other instruction I'll give is that to anyone who's watching, no recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. But there will be an audio recording of this oral argument on our website, and that should be posted tomorrow. It's usually within 24 hours of the oral argument. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Amber Lamers, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Jeremy Keim. We are here today because the court's improper interpretation of Minnesota Statute 518A.29 and 518A.30 constitutes an error of law. The court's findings related to certain farming expenses constitutes an abuse of discretion by misapplying the law, making clearly erroneous conclusions that are against logic and facts on the record. And the court misapplied the law and abused its discretion by applying the 2022 child support guidelines for an obligation that commenced in June of 2023. The court's interpretation of 518A.29 and 518A.30 are reviewed de novo. Pursuant to 518A.29, to calculate child support, each parent's gross income must first be determined, which includes self-employment income under 518A.30. 518A.30 is clear and unambiguous. Income from self-employment or the operation of a business is defined as gross receipts less cost of goods sold less ordinary and necessary expenses. When the words of a statute are clear and unambiguous, the court must give effect to the plain meaning of the language. Rather than apply the plain meaning of the language here, the court created a different formula and determined appellant's net income, and utilize that formula to determine child support, the foundational basis of which were findings that were clearly erroneous and against logic and facts on the record. The court determined that appellant's net income was at least the sum of the average yearly increase in net worth over 12 years, plus the totality of his monthly expenses for an annual average of $409,426 or $34,118 a month. There are two significant flaws in the court's interpretation of the statute. First, it fails to recognize the increase in appellant's net worth due to the significant passive appreciation of his farmland. At the time of the marriage, the appellant's long-term assets were valued at $2.2 million. As of 2021, his long-term assets had increased in value due to passive appreciation to $8.2 million. The 2008-
Oh, counsel, you would agree that the child support magistrate found that appellant's income was difficult to decipher. And given that, doesn't the case law suggest that the child support magistrate can impute income in this circumstance?
I would agree that the case law allows the court to impute income if an obligor's income is impractical to determine. In this case, while the child support magistrate stated that it was difficult to determine, the child support magistrate went through 518A.30, applied that formula, and calculated an alternative income for the obligor using his tax returns. So while the court said it was difficult to determine, it in fact made that calculation. So, but even if the court didn't have the tax returns, looking at the passive appreciation of appellant's farmland to determine a source of income for child support is an error of law. If you look at the 2008 balance sheet used to determine the market rate to determine appellant's farmland at that point was $2,800 an acre. The 2021 balance sheet uses a market rate of anywhere between $77.51 an acre to $16,500 an acre. That's the same farmland that was determined, the value determined in 2008. One farm alone had increased in value $1.5 million during the 12-year span that the court used to calculate lifestyle income. Increase in net worth is not an indicator of appellant's current income for child support.
Can I ask you, how do you respond to the language that we used in Marx, where we said that the assets and resources of a sole business owner may be properly considered if the figures that were offered about his income don't comport with the evidence of the person's lifestyle? How does that, in your view, work with the language of the statute and the position that you've advanced here, that net worth can't be considered, or the passive, you know, appreciation of the real estate can't be considered?
I would say that passive appreciation isn't an indicator of net worth as far as income for child support. This farmland has appreciated $6 million over the span of 12 years. That's not due to cash flow from my client. That's land sitting there that is simply increased in value, $6 million. That's different than acquiring assets in the Marx case. Also, it's well settled in Minnesota law that property settlements can be a source of income or an asset to divide, but it can't be both. In this case, the court essentially utilized the assets of the farming business awarded to appellant as a source of income to determine child support, which is a double dip.
Did you raise this argument in your initial brief?
I did not. I'm responding to the court's question with that argument, Your Honor.
I mean, the argument more generally about the increase in the passive increase in the value of farmland not being properly considered by the child support magistrate in determining net monthly income.
It is briefed, Your Honor, yes.
In the initial brief, you think that was adequately raised?
I believe so, yes. I don't think I may not have included the specific details as far as the market value in 2008 and 2021, but those are in the exhibits that were utilized by the court to determine lifestyle income. So whether a source of funds is considered income for child support is a legal question reviewed de novo. The second flaw in the court's argument or the court's formula is that the record does not support a finding that appellant is able to meet his monthly expenses from self-employment income alone. The court relied on a budget which estimated expenses of $7,584 a month. Appellant was never questioned on that budget other than to inquire that it was created for a different court hearing. In fact, when opposing counsel introduced the exhibit, counsel specifically stated, without belaboring the individual line items, the total amount needed is $7,584 on this exhibit, correct? That was the inquiry as far as that budget. There was no testimony that the budget reflected appellant's current expenses. And in fact, that budget included $1,130 of health insurance and uninsured medical expenses, yet finding of fact 11 of the June 26 order confirms appellant was receiving medical assistance at the time of the hearing, meaning he had no expense for insurance or uninsured costs. When questioned on how appellant meets his monthly expenses, he specifically testified he's only able to pay them by utilizing a $750,000 line of credit from the bank. He further testified that as of—
Did he actually testify that he was only able to pay utilizing that line of credit, or did he testify that he had a line of credit that he—
the specific question was, how do you meet your monthly expenses? And he said, I have a line of credit that I utilize to meet my farming and personal expenses. He also testified that as of May 2023, he had already utilized $720,000 of that line of credit to meet his personal and farming expenses.
When so question- he lumped them together, personal and farming.
Correct? Yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, thank you.
And when asked if he paid that line of credit off each year, he testified that it was not paid off yearly and that the 2022 line of credit had an outstanding balance owed. Now, despite appellant's clear testimony that he was not able to meet his monthly expenses from income alone, the court made a finding that appellant is able to maintain a lifestyle with monthly expenses of $7,584 and that he's able to meet those expenses on an ongoing basis. The court's findings are clearly erroneous and against logic and facts on the record, yet they were utilized to establish lifestyle income of $34,118 a month. Using the lifestyle income argument, the court relied on Roach versus Pura, 534 Northwest 2nd 560. In that case, the court did find it was proper to impute income based on earning capacity when it was otherwise impractical to determine income. And as I stated earlier, the court in the June 26 order demonstrated that it had sufficient income to calculate appellant's gross income from self-employment using the formula in 518A.30, as the court included specific findings as to that actual calculation. In Hayfield, the Minnesota Supreme Court found that the statute instructs the district court to calculate income from self-employment using the formula itself when practical. In this case, the information presented was practical and allowed the court to provide that calculation. The court
can I ask you a question? Do you, in your view, do we need to reach the issue of whether the magistrate clearly erred regarding whether your client can meet monthly expenses if we agree with you that the magistrate misapplied the law by imputing income based on the passive appreciation of real estate and evaluating his net worth?
I think that they're all tied together, Your Honor. So I think what the court, my understanding of what the court did with lifestyle income is based it specifically on the passive appreciation and his ability to meet these monthly expenses. So I think that they're one in the same. If the court remands the case and the court is not obligated to look at monthly expenses, I think that could create another error.
And so you're asking for remand instructions that specifically would specifically outline that the ability to meet monthly expenses, the method that the magistrate used was erroneous.
I think if the court remanded finding that it was erroneous and instructed the court to apply the formula in 518A.30, it wouldn't need to determine anything related to the monthly expenses.
Thank you.
So the court also calculated gross monthly income, which I know you argue that certain expenses were not properly or certain pieces of that calculation were not properly included, but is the approach the court took with respect to gross monthly income the appropriate approach in your view?
It is, Your Honor. I think that the court's secondary or alternative calculation applying 518A.30 is the appropriate method to determine appellant's gross income. The issue with that is that the court made findings that were against logic and facts on the record and also found a source of income that isn't income for the appellant. So when the court determined appellant's gross income, it's determined that a net operating loss, which made up the majority of appellant's income under that calculation, was income to him. So the court determined that a net operating loss from 2013, 14, and 17 was a source of income to appellant in 2021 and 22. This is a legal question that is reviewed de novo, and I do believe that the court needs to correct this error because these parties have four children. There are going to be three more child support modifications under the framework that this child support magistrate set forth in its order. So when doing the alternative approach to determine appellant's gross income, the court took this net operating loss from 10 years ago and made it income to the appellant for child support. It's not income. A net operating loss cannot be income to an obligor. It does not fall within the formula utilized to determine income. And it's a misinterpretation of 518A.30 to turn this loss from 10 years ago as to a source of income for child support this year.
Yep. So is it an ordinary and necessary expense?
I wouldn't say that. So it is not on the profit or loss. So the net operating loss occurs when a farmer's deductions for the year are more than its income. The net operating loss is then carried forward. It's not as an expense on the profit or loss in loss. It's on Schedule 1 of the return as negative other income. It's from 10 years ago. Was it a necessary and ordinary expense 10 years ago? Possibly. There's no information on the record to determine what that net operating loss is. But the appropriate way to treat that loss is to exclude it from the calculation altogether. My client, the appellant, did not look to reduce his income by this net operating loss. Just as the court cannot add it as income, a source of income in 2021, a loss from 10 years ago, it should be excluded from the calculation altogether.
So your view is it doesn't fit within the definition of self-employment income?
I would say it does not fit within the definition of self-employment income. It is not a source of income that an obligor can draw from to pay his child support. The other issue, so the appellant's brief clearly articulates many different findings that we believe the court abused its discretion with. Without waiving those, I'm just going to articulate the net operating loss and the depreciation expense. So the court also added half of the depreciation expense back, finding that appellant failed to establish what amount was accelerated. That finding is clearly erroneous. The accountant submitted post-hearing depreciation schedules, changing the 2021 and 22 depreciation from accelerated to straight line. Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I finish briefly?
Briefly, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I would note that with the depreciation, that had the accountant modified the previous year's depreciation schedules to straight line, it would have increased the appellant's depreciation expense in 2021 and 22 because the assets were put into place 5 to 20 years ago on a 7-year, 150 declining balance method of depreciation. So the accelerated part of the depreciation had already been utilized by the parties many years ago. And changing those older assets to straight line would have increased the depreciation expense, which is not what 518A.30 stands for as far as excluding accelerated depreciation component. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel David Lebo for respondent Tanya M. Kahn. Appellant is framing it otherwise, but this is almost entirely a run-of-the-mill challenge to the findings rather than the law that governed this case. Appellant is asking the court to find legal issues among well-settled case law that does not conflict with the child support statutes. And that this panel cannot overrule as precedential opinions from previous panels. We have very little to add beyond our brief. I'll respond briefly to what appellant has argued today. He seems to assume that this court should disregard almost entirely the child support magistrate's credibility finding. The child support magistrate, we believe with ample support in the record, found that neither appellant nor his expert were credible. That hasn't been challenged here on appeal, and so it has been waived. But even if it hadn't, the case law is that testimony that and other evidence that is not credible need not be accepted even where there is nothing else in the record challenging it. And that really underlines everything that is being argued here, or rebuts much of what's being argued here. The record shows that appellant used every tax advantage that is available to farmers, and some that were not legal in the first place, to minimize his taxable income. And one of the unstated assumptions that appellant is making here is that the tax returns are really all that the court can look to. But the magistrate pointed out explicitly, and the case law supports, that tax returns are evidence of income, but they're not conclusive. There are lots of reasons for that. This case shows some of them. So the magistrate recognized that and turned to the other methods that are available to her under case law.
The case law, I think, is fairly clear that when it's impracticable to determine actual income, a district court may impute income. But I'm not aware of any case where the increase in wealth was used to calculate monthly income. And, you know, in the Marks case, it was calculated by adding wages and interest income. And in the Roach case, I don't think there was reliance on an increase in asset value. Can you point us to any case where monthly income or gross income was calculated or imputed based on an increase in asset value?
So I think Marks.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
For child support purposes.
So I think that Marks does
have some language, but I don't think the court considered assets based on my review of the language of that case.
So we cite at page 14 of our brief a quote from Marx at 529 that the assets and resources of a sole business owner may properly be considered if the figures offered do not comport with the evidence of that person's lifestyle. That cites Johnson v. Fritz, which is 406 Northwest 2nd, 614. That's a 1987 case. One thing I would note on that.
I agree with your cites to those cases, but I think when you look at those cases, they didn't actually rely on assets or the calculation of income didn't actually rely on an increase in the value of assets.
Well, I mean, think
you're correct in the language that you cite that the case says that assets may properly be considered, but I don't think that the case actually involved a calculation based on the increase in the value of the assets.
I think that close a factual analog, I can't cite anything to the court off the top of my head here. At the same time, I think that that's clearly a valid legal basis for the court, the child support magistrate to, search for a reasonable method to calculate appellant's income. And I also think, I do want to make sure that I note that appellant and Judge Cochran, I think you kind of touched on this during appellant's argument, that appellant's argument on net income shifted a little bit. In his principal brief, the argument was that it misinterprets the child support statutes and constitutes an error of law, the way that the child support magistrate calculated the net income that ultimately became the basis for the child support order. But by the time of his reply brief, and certainly today, he's arguing not that this is so much a legal error that it's a factual error, that the appreciation was passive, which is an argument that he does not have, I think, record support for. And that land does not decrease in value, which he doesn't cite anything, and we don't believe is the least bit true. So the fact is that there is a huge increase in his assets and his net worth. He's a farmer, and that increase is associated with his farming operation. And so I don't think the record supports the idea that this is passive, that it can't be attributed to him. He had a chance to make that argument and or provide support for that below, and he didn't.
So are you arguing then that appellant's principal brief, the initial brief, really didn't advance the argument that the defect with evaluating net worth lay in the fact that it relied on the passive appreciation of real estate, and that really only came out in the reply brief?
Correct. Yes. And this section of his argument is three paragraphs long paragraphs. But it talks about Marx, it talks about Roach, it analyzes those cases, but it never suggests that the net income finding is erroneous, much less clear error. The last sentence of that section says, utilizing, and this is toward the bottom of page 13, utilizing a method based on the sum of the average yearly increase in net worth plus the totality of appellant's annual monthly expenses to determine his net income is an improper calculation of appellant's income for child support and constitutes an error of law, not fact, not clear error, error of law. So that's a challenge, we understand it, to the ability to use Marx and Roach here. And we don't believe that came out adequately, really at all, until the reply brief. So we believe that's been waived.
Well, is there something in the record that you think supports the, other than the passive appreciation of property, that supports the way the magistrate looked to net worth as a reliable indicator of income here?
Well, I think that's a decision that's vested heavily in the child support magistrate, first of all. But I think the budget, his own budget, first of all. And I would note that his counsel talked about his budget at least once in the transcript. And in fact, one of the answers, one of the bits of testimony that he cited was in response to a question about how he met the monthly expenses on his budget. But I think the budget plus, you know, something else. Budget obviously is a measure of gross income, or excuse me, of net income. Gross income would be more. And he is kind of trying to say that not only is his budget too high, there's nothing else above and beyond his budget. So again, he's farming. He is buying more, he's buying more assets. A lot of that, I think, is off budget. These are living expenses, not business expenses. And that is part of the appreciation of his net, or the increase in his net worth. So I think there is every reason to believe that his budget is only a starting point. The magistrate needs to base the determination here on something. And I think this was a reliable measure with support in the record. And again, I'd note that there wasn't an argument that I have seen that, well, this was only passive appreciation, much less any record evidence. He's asking the court here to assume that really for the first time today.
Could we talk about the alternative method? How do you figure that net operating losses are income to him?
So his counsel this morning has said, well, it's a subtraction from other income. Now, I'm not an accountant, but if it's a subtraction from other income, he would have a lot more other income on his gross income on his tax return.
But it doesn't a deduction on the tax return. In other words, it doesn't reduce the taxable income. Does it?
Well, I think that's an expert question, and I think that his expert didn't explain that, if that was going to be his argument.
Well, I was looking at the tax return, and it isn't listed as a loss or an expense against income. So I'm trying to figure how that becomes income to him.
I think that it's a little bit hard to discern. Again, I think that it's a question for an expert. He had an expert. She testified. She didn't explain sort of how this works. And appellant doesn't really explain how it works either.
You can't explain it?
I'm not exactly sure, without really digging into the tax return in a way that I'm not sure I'm qualified to do for this.
That's not too helpful to me.
this is I think exactly the problem, Your Honor, is, you know, this is a complex tax return. This is not something for which we would typically expect a judicial officer to be able to parse out without the help of an expert. That's why these rules are there, and that's why appellant recognized that by finding an expert.
But isn't that a factual issue? I mean, if the child support magistrate concludes erroneously that the appellant was deducting the net operating losses from the tax returns, and the tax returns show that the net operating losses actually weren't being deducted against his income, why wouldn't we find that to be clearly erroneous?
Well, I think that it is a fact. To answer the first part of your question, it is a factual question. Absolutely. If that's true, then there might also be a legal issue. But, you know, is it error? Is it clear error? And I'm not sure how the court can figure that out based on the evidence in the record. I don't think that without an expert that there is the evidence, the ability to do that, especially given that appellant had an expert who didn't or couldn't explain this, and that it's his burden to show this, I think. This is an item on his own tax returns. And, he called an expert who didn't explain this. He apparently allowed the magistrate to make this error without seeking district court review, which might have been a chance to supplement the record. And here we are. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. So, any rebuttal from appellant?
Your Honor, I would note that appellant's expert did testify in detail as to what the net operating loss was, how it's calculated, the amounts for 2013, 14, 17, and 17 beyond. There was very clear testimony regarding what that constitutes, what years it was calculated, and how it impacted, if at all, appellant's current income for child support.
Okay, but the magistrate found your expert not to be credible. How does that square?
I would take issue with the court's finding regarding credibility for two reasons. First, the court implied that the expert came on and testified that all of appellant's expenses were ordinary necessary expenses for his business, and implied that only on cross-examination did these issues come out. That is factually untrue. The transcript is very clear that the expert testified specifically on direct that other than a few expenses, the rest are ordinary necessary. And then the expert testified specifically to what those other expenses are and added those back into appellant's income for child support on direct.
So we generally defer to the credibility determinations that are made below. So if we were to defer to that credibility determination, how would you answer Judge Smith's question?
Can you ask the question again? I'm sorry.
Well, I think, you know, the question has to do with the expenses and and I'll let Judge Smith restate his question, but basically and the need for expert testimony, but the district or the child support magistrate found the expert to be not credible. We generally defer to those credibility determinations. I know you're arguing against that, but my question is, how would you answer Judge Smith's original question if we were to defer to that credibility determination, which I think is what he was getting at? But Judge
That's
Smith,
correct.
Why don't you re-ask your question?
Yeah, that is my question. If how can we rely on that expert explanation of what income is if the magistrate says that that testimony is not credible?
Well, the magistrate's test or the finding regarding the lack of credibility had to do with the initial testimony regarding necessary and ordinary expenses related to attorney's fees and appraisal fees, and also depreciation. So that was the larger issue that the court made findings on with regard to credibility for the expert. But the magistrate has a misunderstanding of accelerated depreciation. So the finding related to credibility of this expert's testimony on that issue.
But what's it, I think what we were just talking about was the net operating losses.
So the magistrate.
And the magistrate adding those back in.
Yes. So the magistrate, what the magistrate did is said that the net operating loss from is not a business expense incurred for the year of filing. It was not a depreciation expense and was not an ordinary necessary expense for the business for the year of filing. And I would agree with that, but that doesn't make it a source of income for the appellant. I don't know that the magistrate made findings regarding the credibility of the expert related to the net operating loss. And I don't know how a net operating loss, I'm not an accountant either, but I understand what a net operating loss is. And a loss from 10 years ago that's allowed to carry forward every year on a tax return cannot be income 10 years later. Not to mention that the court used the same net operating loss in 2021 and 2022 and added it back to appellant's income. They double dipped on that net operating loss and added it as income both years and then averaged those 2 years out for appellant. I don't know if I answered the court's question. Maybe you could specify if I didn't.
You have any follow-up, Judge Smith?
Well, this is the dilemma. The magistrate has found that the expert is not credible. And it's hard to determine to the extent to which that testimony is reliable in any event. So how do we not just accept the findings of the magistrate when the magistrate has found that expert not credible?
I would say that the court reviews whether a source of funds is considered income for child support. The court reviews that de novo. These are actual figures on a tax return, regardless of the expert's testimony as to what year they were incurred. These are net operating losses from 10 years ago, and those numbers don't change regardless of what expert testifies to them. I would like to briefly respond.
Your time is up. So any further questions from the panel?
I do not.
No, thank you.
You can briefly conclude if you like.
Yes, I conclude. I was going to answer the question related to the initial brief and the responsive brief with regard to the passive appreciation. But in conclusion, the appellant requests that this court reverse the court's decision to use lifestyle to determine appellant's net income for child support and remand with specific instructions related to the source of funds available for appellant, the farming expenses disregarded by the magistrate, and utilization of a child support guideline that was in place when the time the obligation commenced rather when the case started. If we're looking at using a child support guideline that's in place when a case initiated, all modifications would need to follow suit. And that would be completely misapplying the law. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.